From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made last week in the village of Honeoye Falls when a group known as the Eastside Anti-Fascists distributed flyers. Those flyers warned that a man from Honeoye Falls had attended the Charlottesville demonstrations in support of white nationalism. His name is Jared Kuhn, and his family says they've been threatened and harassed. The mayor of Honeoye Falls denounced white nationalism but said that any protests in Honeoye Falls should be peaceful and respectful of individual families. Honeoye Falls is hardly the only community that is grappling with how to interact with someone like Jared Kuhn. Since the events in Charlottesville, marchers have been identified in many towns. Some have said they're being forced out of college or jobs. Well, this hour, a conversation about the way forward. And I'd like to welcome our guests for the hour, a couple of guests from the new Movement for Anti-Racist Ministry and Action, known as MAMA, M-A-M-A. Reverend Judy Davis is a member of the steering committee. Reverend, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And Pastor Wanda Wilson, also a member of the steering committee of MAMA. Pastor Wilson, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
Also with us in studio is Rabbi Peter Stein, who's a senior rabbi at Temple Brith Kodesh. Rabbi Stein, welcome to you.
Thank you, Evan.
And with us is Julia Ortenzi, who is a graduate of Honeoye Falls, Lima, and a student now at Sarah Lawrence College. And I asked Julia to come on the program because I thought she wrote a very, a tough but eloquent post online that reflects her views. And Julia, thank you for taking the time to join us here.
Thank you.
Let me ask our guests, just before we get into some of those specifics, just for some brief reaction to what we're going to do is start with the story of what's going on in individual communities like the Honeoye Falls of the world, and then sort of a broader look at a way forward. And I guess, Reverend Judy Davis, I'll start with you. You know, Charlottesville, for a lot of people, was... I don't know if it's a wake-up call per se. I mean, our friends of color have said, it's not a wake-up call for us. We've been trying to warn you for a long time. But in many ways, for many Americans, I think it has been. What is your immediate takeaway from Charlottesville so far?
Looking at Charlottesville, I think that it brings to the surface the reality that we live, part of the community is living in denial. Denial that institutional structural racism actually exists. There is a book by Tim Weiss that talks about speaking treason fluently. And what he means is when you begin to speak in a way to uplift that white supremacy is still alive in this nation, in this country, the government and political institutions, all of our institutions are so aligned with white supremacy that when we start to speak and show the incongruency between white supremacy and what we believe that we're actually doing, that it sounds like treason because it's so aligned with the way that we already operate in this nation.
Hmm. Pastor Wilson, how do you feel?
Well, for me, Charlottesville... my reaction emotionally was I was very angry and very hurt. I think people in the black community and people of color are tired of racism, tired of the effects of racism, tired of this country, of our communities not dealing with racism, wanting and desiring and having a heart for the change, wanting to have authentic conversation, having people to take their heads out of the sand and deal with the evil that is embedded in our nation.
Hmm. Rabbi Stein, for you, I imagine, again, it's maybe a similar sentiment that I would imagine you were not surprised to hear marchers in Charlottesville saying Jews will not replace us. Unfortunately, anti-Semitism is alive and well. But do you feel... at all, that there is any possible benefit to the country seeing this more at large?
Well, I certainly think that anybody who considers this to be a wake-up call is because they were keeping their eyes closed. They were ignoring the realities in terms of hatred, whether it's anti-Semitism, which is alive and well and really pervasive, racism, and all sorts of hatred that are in all parts of our community, whether or not we pay attention to it, that's the key, is we need to notice it, we need to take action, and we need to stop it. We can't normalize it.
Julia, for you as a student, you graduated from HFL when?
2015.
And there was essentially a sense, based on the post that you wrote on that I read on social media, that you were perhaps not surprised that a fellow student would end up at Charlottesville. And I would ask you if you're willing to read what you wrote, because I thought it was strong, and I think it's a kind of message that I think some people should hear. So if you're willing, I'd love for you to do that.
Yeah, I can do that.
Okay.
Right now?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
We, the Hunnewe Falls Lima community, should not be surprised. It's so easy to be shocked right now, as if Jared Kuhn and the beliefs he holds come out of nowhere. It's easy to pretend we never saw it coming. But I walked those halls for all of my first and secondary education, and so did all of you. We heard the same rhetoric spewed then during government class, during psych, on the bus, in the lunchroom, that we now hear screamed at white supremacist rallies with torches and Nazi armbands. How many of us heard something racist and brushed it off as teenagers being teenagers? They'll grow out of it is a phrase I've heard too many times. But they are grown now. They're not misguided teens. They're immoral men and women, and we all let it get to that point. We went to a school with a 1% black population, surrounded from a young age by people who looked like us, alienated from non-white, non-Christian people. Our administration and our district made little to no effort to integrate our schools out of fear that those big bad city kids, read black children, would taint our quaint suburban bubble. And now we're surprised that one of our number is acting on the beliefs this community cultivated and allowed to grow. We don't get to be surprised, we get to be ashamed. White parents, if you are not speaking to your white children about racism, about police brutality, about the struggles that black and brown children face in this day and age, you are complicit. White teachers, if you are only teaching white European history, you are complicit. If you see or hear racism and/or racist views within your classroom and you stay silent under the guise of respecting everyone's opinions equally, you are complicit. White students, if you hear a racist remark, whether it's from the mouth of one of your friends or not, say something. You may not change their specific views, but you are letting them know that their racism is not accepted or tolerated within this environment. Hunnewe Falls Lima District, you need to wake up and do better.
Let me just follow up before I ask our guests to respond to some of what you said there. Who have you heard from since you posted that? I saw a lot of response online, but I wonder if the district itself has responded.
The district itself that I know of has not responded to my post, but a lot of community members have, whether or not they were HFL grads in the same general time period that I was. A lot of positive, a lot of saying, yeah, I noticed this too. Thank you for bringing this up. And then a lot of people, like, absolutely, like, I shocked them. What are you talking about? We don't have racism here. A lot of community members expressing some surprise and anger.
And when you hear from, you know, fellow white community members generally saying, oh, come on, that's not us. We don't have racism here. Well, how do you respond to them?
I think that denial is really prevalent within our community. If the conversation is clearly going to be one where nobody gets through to the other person and it's not like genuine surprise, it's like anger that I would even insinuate and a strong protectiveness of the community. And if they're swearing at me, I don't really engage because Facebook fights aren't always productive. But I do like to message people personally and have that conversation off the post, because mm-hmm. I feel like people are less defensive when they don't feel like they're being watched like that, and they're much more susceptible to having their opinions changed.
And have people said some rough things to you because of the post?
Not in person.
Not in person, but
not
in
person.
But online?
Online I've had some community members, not personal insults, but basically like you're, you know, a privileged liberal, you don't know what you're talking about, that sort of thing, which is standard.
Okay. Well, she says it's standard. Let's ask Reverend Judy Davis, what do you think of Julia's message there for her fellow former classmates and her community to sort of grapple and try to get our heads around, honestly, what's going on, not just in Hunnewe Falls, but in communities across the country?
Well, to to look at the definition of white supremacy, to understand that it's the domination through our institutions, including our educational institutions, of every facet of the lives of those who can't be ascribed whiteness on a basis of a doctrine that one group is superior and the other group is inferior. So just looking at any school across this nation or here in Rochester, racism is right there. We're not talking about individual racism, but we also talk about institutional and structural racism. So what schools across this nation aren't using a Eurocentric curriculum? What schools are including the contributions of African Americans, Latinos, et cetera? Just looking at our teaching staff, there's plenty of articles out there that share that if African-American children have a same-race teacher between third and fifth grade, they're more likely to finish college and to go on to finish high school and go on to college. So there's plenty of evidence and understanding out there of what's needed for African-Americans and Latinos to be successful. But when you look at our actual educational system, look at the processes, look at the procedures, look at the laws that govern it, all of them create inequitable outcomes that are well documented.
Okay. Pastor Wilson, thoughts on what Julia had to say to her fellow community members in HFL?
I would just say for those who did respond to you and you said there was some shame in that or some that did respond positively, I'm not sure what positively is, but for those who really want to make a difference or care, you said that the district has not responded to you yet. Get those people together and go and talk to the district and talk to your 1% population of people of color and see what they are going through and what can be done to make a change.
Is that something you would do, Julia?
Absolutely. I do go to college full-time in about a week, but there were enough people to get something started for sure, and I think that we need to seize this momentum before it dies out, like a lot of, you know, small community issues do. People like to brush it under the rug and forget about it. We had a sidewalk chalk sort of like community coming together and like writing love on things, and that's a really lovely idea, but I think if it's not partnered with action, it's not partnered with concrete change, then nothing's going to come of this. And I think that you're right. We absolutely need to push our community leaders, specifically the mayor and education leaders, to do something about this.
Now, Rabbi, when it comes to the kinds of responses we could have as a community, we heard, she just mentioned Mayor Rick Milne from Honeoye Falls, who we know very well on this program, and he, what his statement entailed was essentially he condemns white nationalism, but he also doesn't want to see individual families harassed. You know, the family, Mr. Kuhn's family had reported death threats, those kinds of things. And I wonder how you feel about what the proper response is when you have these moments where people feel a lot of tension, whether it's seeing what happened in Charlottesville or seeing that, well, you know, now we've got these flyers and someone is, you know, one of the prominent marchers is here in town. And what do we say something? Do we say something to the family? What's appropriate? How do you feel about what's appropriate to have that kind of conversation?
I think what's most important is that we treat things that should be on the outside as on the outside. We can't normalize them and treat them as regular, ordinary, acceptable behaviors. So what's powerful in the post is what fuels this and what advances hate is segregation and separation and marginalizing a population. Historically, we certainly know that from many different examples. We look at the South during the earlier era, where what happened was a population was marginalized and separated. You look at the evolution in Germany through the Nazi era, and what happened was that population, which had been integrated and mainstreamed, was step by step by step marginalized and taken out. So certainly I believe in acting peacefully and acting positively, but I also believe that when there's something that is urgent and something that is critically important, we have to advance the discomfort. We have to make people uncomfortable if they're going to make a change.
Okay. Well, and let me ask Pastor Wilson, how do you feel about the way forward? What the appropriate conversations are?
I think the appropriate conversations are, if you're going to have the conversation on race, be real about it. Come to the table, especially to white people, come to the table expecting to be uncomfortable. Because having a conversation about racism is not going to be a comfortable conversation. And you have to want to come out of your comfort zone. You're going to have to be able to understand the history of people of color since they've been in this country. You're going to have to be able to accept what was done, accept the shame, accept the 492 years of oppression that is still continuing today. And you're going to have to be able to give up the privilege. The white privilege has to go. And it's going to require more than just nice, soft conversation. It's going to require sacrifice. significant sacrifice. Sacrifice from a financial standpoint, economic standpoint, political standpoint. This is deep work. This is not soft work. This is going to require some real transformation.
And Pastor, if I can follow that up with a question from a listener named Don on Twitter who says, would your guests like to say anything to whites anxious about becoming a minority in this country expected to happen by 2044? What Don has said is that I think the concern is that, you know, he sees movements like Black Lives Matter as being advocating the cause of Black Americans, and he is concerned about whites becoming a minority, and he hears you say sacrifice, and the question is, what does that mean? What's the vision for this? Are we going to have a peaceful society? So Don is concerned about that. What would you say to someone like Don?
He's concerned about, can you clarify that?
He wants to know, you know, what you would say about whites who are anxious about becoming a minority in this country.
Okay, I would ask him, why is he anxious about becoming a minority?
I don't know, but I suspect he might fear retribution. I don't know. As you said, it's a zero-sum game here. That when it comes to privilege, we have to be willing to sacrifice, right?
We're looking for equal justice.
And right now we don't have equality.
And we don't have equality.
We know that.
So that's what we're looking for. So again, my question back to Don is, what is the fear of being the minority?
Evan, I have a thought as well, which is, I think we need, from a religious point of view, as a member of the clergy, from a religious point of view, what is profoundly important to me is the absolute equality of each and every human being. So whether someone finds themselves in the majority or in the minority, or whether there are demographic changes that are happening, that's nothing which is a threat. That is nothing which is a negative. Rather, we need to own it and live with it and say every person has beauty and importance and equality. And if there are shifts that are happening in the society, we need to embrace it, even if there is that discomfort that some people may feel.
Sure. Go ahead, please.
I'd like to add, the question I would ask is, who has the power? So you may become a minority, but if the political, social, economic, all of those systems are still being run majorly by whites, then what is actually being lost? If the system is still set up to create undeserved privileges or undeserved advantage to a group over another group, if you have not changed the power dynamics, being in the minority does not necessarily mean that you're on the losing end. If you still control all the systems that are already embedded with policies, practices, and procedures that create inequitable outcomes by not just race, but gender, class, etc.
Yeah, I am deeply interested in epistemology. How do people form their beliefs? What are they concerned about? What are their fears? I don't know Don personally, and just from his tweet, all I can infer is that he might be concerned about, if whites become a minority, retribution. Let's be honest about how remarkable this is right here. White people in this country took land from Native Americans. You know, dispossession was at the root of this country's founding, and enslaved an entire race of people. And the people who simply want equality are not saying, well, we get equality plus we get to enslave white people. We're not talking about retribution in that way. We're talking about a simple desire for equality. Now, maybe he doesn't trust that. But Pastor Wilson, I actually find there's something beautiful and remarkable in simply a desire for equality in the face of decades and centuries of oppression, torture, enslavement, and more. What do you think?
I agree with you that, and this conversation reminds me of the story of Mandela, and when they were getting ready to free Mandela from being in prison, and he had to go meet with all of the white leadership of South Africa, and their main question, their fear was, and he had to ask them, why are you so afraid of black people of color being the majority? And their response to him was, because you might do to us what we did to you. So take that back and think about that.
And that's why I think there's something remarkable and beautiful about the fact that, I mean, imagine you wake up every day for 10 years and someone starts the day by just punching you in the face. And you've been asking them for years, can you just not do that? Your concern is, well, if I stop doing that, are you going to punch me back? And the answer is, no, we just want to be able to live with equality and respect here.
Right. We want the same equal rights, the same justice that white people receive. We want the same equal political stances, racial justice, social justice as white people receive in America.
And I view what we saw in Charlottesville, the race-based sentiment, and then you saw, again, the chanting of Jews will not replace us. Obviously, there are some connected threads here, but are there different origins, Rabbi? I mean, how do you view, you know, so much of what fuels the fear and hatred of African Americans, and then the sentiments that cause someone to march in the street and say Jews will not replace us?
I think broadly speaking, they are very closely linked together in the sense of being minority populations who became targets in one way or another. And Jewish identity in America has been through a very interesting evolution because Jews came to America, and while they still are a minority, they came as a very distinct minority without access to a lot of societal privileges, whether it was jobs, whether it was schools, whether it was other institutions. That has changed dramatically in the integration and assimilation of the Jewish population. But at the same time, Jews are still a very small minority and therefore become a target. So I think there are different elements to the hatred that we're seeing. But part of it is this very unfortunate reminder that Jews are still a minority who are targeted and hated very simply because of their identity.
And Julia, can I just ask you to kind of follow up on a theme that we've already visited with you, which is this. I drove up through the Southern Tier a week ago, and I noticed a lot of Confederate flags. And I mentioned this to some friends, but they warned me. They said, don't just stereotype. This is not just Confederate flags in rural areas, and this should not be reduced to a low-income, rural thing. That this is in our suburbs, this is in our communities, that it is a privileged thing to be able to pretend that racism does not exist among us everywhere. You agree with that?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Was that part of your mission of communicating to fellow community members in HFL with your post, that there's sort of a denialism out there about that?
Absolutely, there's a denialism. I think that there's always this surprised reaction every time anything racist happens in Hunnewe Falls. And, like, they refuse to see a pattern. And it's there's a reason that we continuously have racist events, and we get Democrat and Chronicle articles written about us for being racist, is because there is a general lack of understanding about racial issues at all. There is very little diversity. And then you have, you know, a group of generally wealthy young people being raised in a town with only, like, white people and white opinions, you know, up until the age of 20. And then they go to college and they're shocked that the whole world doesn't look like Hunnewe Falls. And I think that the school needs to better prepare its students for the rest of the world, because the blunders that white children make at the age of 4 and 5, that they're, you know, their parents sit them down and say, well, you can't say that because of this. And, you know, these conversations that are had at such a young age are not being had in Hunnewe Falls because there's no opportunity for them. So they're being had with fully formed personalities at the age of 19 and 20, where they already have, they're not impressionable children who can say, oh, okay, Dad, that makes sense. You know, I won't say that. They're, you know, defensive and already have, like, a political affiliation, and they already have opinions about all these things. There's such a deniability, and it's a lack of community responsibility, I think.
Before we take our break at the half-hour mark, because we're going to be welcoming a couple of other of the steering committee members from the new Movement for Anti-Racist Ministry and Action, known as MAMA, MAMA. So you hear that acronym. It's the Movement for Anti-Racist Ministry and Action. And we're going to welcome in a couple of other members of their steering committee. I want to follow up via email. Tim in Pittsford says, can the Reverend explain what kind of a financial sacrifice white people are going to have to make? You heard sacrifice. So, mm-hmm. Pastor Wilson, Tim's asking more specifically, what do you mean by that?
I think white people, they have the power when it comes to economics and finances. And that means, like, they could give more to communities that are lacking or that have less. When it comes to finances, if they could actually in the job markets, if white people who are in power and do the hiring, if they would be willing to hire more people of color, and that way that would help people of color to have a better economic base. So they have to be willing to, again, sacrifice, pour into urban communities that don't have the financial base to bring themselves up to the same level as maybe a Pittsford or a Penfield.
Okay, and Reverend, some final thoughts from you, because I know we're going to hear from other steering committee members. Some thoughts from you to Tim and then generally speaking.
I guess I want to go back to the power issue, that at this point, persons of color do not have the economic power, political power, social power to bring about anything for whites to fear at this point. The question is asked often in some seminars, how are black lives impacted by systems? And they can talk about, you know, redlining with housing. They can talk about education being barred from it. They can talk about a list of things that take place because of systems. But when you ask, well, what can the black person do to every white person across the nation using their economic, political, and social power, the room is silent. And so this fear of retribution, this fear of losing something, all these fears, those fears right now, I would say, would be baseless until there's equity in power and who's the decision makers in politics, in economics, in education, et cetera. And so I just don't want that loss, that we understand that individual action of Mr. Kuhn, but we have to go beyond that and look at institutional actions. When you look at institutions, what are your HR policies? What are your criteria for various other institutions, and understand that that's what's blocking, and those are the kinds of conditions that are creating the hostility between people groups right now.
All right, we're going to get our only break of the hour, and we'll come back with our guests, including two more members of MAMA, the Movement for Anti-Racist Ministry in Action. Our thanks to Reverend Judy Davis. Great to have you, Reverend. Thank you for being
here.
Pastor Wanda Wilson, thank you, Pastor, for being here as well.
Thank you.
We'll get that short break, and if you're on the phone, Rich in Rochester, we're going to come to you. 844-295-TALK as well, if you want to join the conversation. 844-295-8255. Coming up in our second hour, the healing power of horses and a brand new field welcoming to athletes from all backgrounds. Child in a wheelchair, maybe a child in your family who has a disability, who has felt discouraged from ever getting on a sporting field. That's not the case at Challenger Miracle Field in Webster. We'll tell those stories of inclusion coming up next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We're talking about not only what happened in Charlottesville, but conversations that are happening in communities across the country as we discuss how to interact with people who marched in Charlottesville and live in our communities. We saw that kind of debate and question in Honeyoye Falls last week. And here from Honeyoye Falls is an HFL graduate and a student at Sarah Lawrence College, Julia Ortenzi. Rabbi Peter Stein is a senior rabbi at Temple Brith Kodesh. And joining us now in studio are two more members of the steering committee of the Movement for Anti-Racist Ministry and Action. Howard Eagle, welcome back to the program, Howard.
Thank you for having us on.
And Andrea Bryant as well. Andrea, welcome to you.
Thank you. I'm Rachel.
I'm sorry, I've got you. Of course, I've got the wrong. Hi, Rachel. Rachel, and you're also an MCC student as well, right?
Yes.
Thanks for being here, Rachel. And so Howard and Rachel representing MAMA, which M-A-M-A, which is a pretty new organization, Howard?
Yes, we launched the organization on the 7th of this month, August 7th, and had our first public event on the 10th, which was a forum, school board candidates forum.
Let me ask both of the steering committee members from MAMA to weigh in on what they've been hearing, and then we're going to take some of your phone calls and get some of your reactions as well. And Rachel, I'll start with you. I know you had a chance to hear some of what our guests said in our first half hour. One of the big questions now is moving forward, what kind of conversations are going to be effective in driving this kind of conversation to building bridges? I mean, Julia is asking her, you know, fellow white graduate students, community members, to be a lot more open and honest about our own history. What are the kinds of things that you think can happen that would be effective in our communities?
I think the most effective thing would be to first acknowledge the problem and accept that we all have our own prejudices, and that we all, even though we may not know it or may not be consciously aware, have our own racist ideas and things in our head. It's just how we act on it. And if we can accept the fact that you may not be aware that you have a, or that you are affected by racism, then you'll be more effective in getting a change. Denial is the worst thing you can do, because if you can't accept it, then how are you going to want to affect the change? If you don't see the problem, how can you try and fix it? So I think to be the most effective, you have to start by doing that. And then it's okay to talk about it, and it's okay to have conversations about it, but you have to actually do something. You can't just talk about it. We've been talking about it for years and decades, and we haven't seen the change. Everybody kind of tries to sweep it under the rug and act like it doesn't exist anymore. Don't say they see color. Well, if you don't see my color, then you don't see me. So we have to first get it developed inside your heart and your mind that you want the change. Because just to say you want the change because you're scared or have this perceived thought about Black people and people of color, you fear them, there's no reason to fear us. You know, we're normal just like you are. We could fear you because of the past, but we don't. So, I mean, and I just think you have to stop acting on your prejudices. Stop thinking about it in a bad way. Stop seeing people as evil before you know who they are, before you learn about them. And I think that's the first step, to at least bring the change from within yourself. You can't start in a community if you haven't accepted and changed yourself first. And I think we have to come together as a community, and we have to all acknowledge the problem first and stop sweeping it under the rug. Because it's a lot of racism here in Rochester and here in New York that nobody speaks about.
Okay. Howard?
I think the discussion has been good to this point. In my view, not enough has been said about historical perspective. We won't understand something as complex as racism if we don't place our examination into historical context and have a very clear understanding of where this comes from, where it started. It didn't fall from the sky, grow from the ground, or roll in from the sea. It was created by humans, by men, in particular, white men in particular. And we need to have a clear understanding. I haven't heard enough about structural racism, institutional racism, which our Reverend Davis did emphasize those. That's what we really have to understand in terms of what Rachel is talking about as it relates to change. So building bridges is good, and having discussion is good. That's the starting point. Those are baby steps, in my view. But it's the beginning. It's critical that we do that. If we don't do that, we won't do anything else. But we can't stay stuck there. And so if we're serious about change, anti-racist change, then we have to develop very clear goals in terms of what it is we want. When we get done, what will be different? And so I don't hear enough of that, enough talk about solutions. And then, as Rachel mentioned, the talk should drive action. That, so discussion, education, knowledge, the purpose of that, the ultimate function of knowledge is to inform us what we have to do if we're serious about change and improvement.
Let me ask you a question before I take a couple of phone calls and some of your emails that have come in. I had a listener on Twitter last week say, you know, Evan, is it, when we talk structural racism, he said, he's asking for a definition,
and
which is a great question. In a second, Howard will give you the definition. Certainly, I think it's valuable to understand that. He asked me, as a member of the media, he said, "Well, what about the fact that the Rideout trial, white family, gets wall-to-wall coverage for weeks, and you rarely see that kind of coverage for victims of color, families of color? Is that structural racism?" I said, "That's not structural racism in the way that Howard's probably going to define it. But is that racism? I think it is." I think that's prejudice for sure. I think the media, we glamorize, you know, coverage of missing white women often, those kind of things. Does that happen for women of color? No. So I think there are levels of it on every part of society. But when you talk about structural racism, Howard, how do you define it?
Because I agree with what Evan is saying in terms of the Rideout case, that what happened in that case is a reflection of institutional racism. An institution functioning in a way that it favors some people over others. That's a clear example of that. structural racism, not that I'm going to give the definition because people define it in different ways, but the fundamentals that we need to understand, if we really want to be clear about what structural racism is, we're talking about the form of racism that was embedded in the fabric and foundation of this society from day one. It was a part of the economic system, the political system, the dominant, quote unquote, dominant cultural system, the social system, from day one. And therefore, all of the major institutions that were developed under that arrangement necessarily would have to reflect that racism. And so that's why we can talk about institutional racism, because it functions by way of the policies, the practices, the procedures, the rules, the regulations that guide and govern the institutions, which are in fact grounded in white supremacist belief and thought.
Okay. So let me go ahead and take some of your phone calls on the subject, and I'm going to start with Rich in Rochester. Go ahead, Rich.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good. Kevin? I wish we had other conversations, Rich, but this is one we got to have. Go ahead.
Yes. I talk a lot to people on Facebook, and a lot of my friends on Facebook are conservatives and everything. People always ask me, why do you talk to them? I almost have a problem with this outing of the Nazis on a personal level, because what you're speaking to today, I have argued for years. Until a black person can move into a neighborhood and the neighborhood does not lose 5% of the value of their property, until a black person can get capital investments in capital goods, software, things like that, and not only a barbershop or a beauty parlor. Until those type of things truly start happening, none of this will change. And in the North, especially the North, is very guilty of that type of racism that is so endemic in our banking system and all the things that really matter. We like to feel good. Well, see, we got rid of this, a Nazi. We're not going to have Nazis in our town. Yet, if I move into your neighborhood for some reason, you think the value of your property has gone down, and it's reflected in the purchasing in these neighborhoods. And until those things really change, and all your guests are touching on it, none of this will change. And that's my frustration. I get so tired of people talking about these individuals. That's not the problem.
All right, Rich, thank you for the phone call. And I certainly understand the sentiment. I think all of our guests will want to weigh in on that. I'll start with Howard. We'll go around the table.
Yeah, I absolutely could not agree with Rich more. He's absolutely correct. But what we need to understand is the fact that African-American people, other people of color, can't move into other neighborhoods and can't get capital and so forth. That's not coincidental. Again, if you want to understand how things got to be that way, we have to put our examination in historical context. We have to know what has been done in housing that prevents African-American people from owning housing at nearly the rate that white people do. We have to understand why capital is not available to African-American people and other people of color. That's what we're talking about. Those are the products. That's the residue of what has been done historically. But we've got to examine what the real disease is. And it is like a disease, which, as I said, has been embedded into the fabric of the society. And so we see that, as Rich mentioned, reflected in all the major institutions, whether it's criminal justice, housing, education. We know we just saw another one of those reports come out in Rochester, the Hard Facts Report. And that report made it clear. This was at the base of all of the inequality and the inability to really move toward equality is structural racism. And so I understand his frustration, but we don't need to be frustrated to the point of being immobile. Our frustration should move us together, unite us to do the work that's going to be necessary if we're serious about change.
Now, Rachel, I think I hear in Rich saying if we get focused too much on individual members, people like Jared Kuhner, anybody in other communities that have been in quote-unquote outed for going to Charlottesville, that we get distracted from the other hard work. But people in Honeyway Falls might feel like, look, we should know who's living with us and among us, and what do we do about that? So how do you deal with that?
I feel it is important to know if we have members of our community who feel so deeply about this kind of situation and have so much hate in their heart that they would go to a rally in a whole nother state just to keep their white supremacy. And I think I think the problem is we can't make too much concrete change because nobody wants to get uncomfortable. I think that it's so, like Howard said, it's structural. It's built in all of our foundations. So in order for us to try and really make a change, it's going to change how everybody's treated, not just the people of color or Hispanics. It's going to change how white people are treated too. And nobody wants to be taken out of their place where they're comfortable, where everything, all of their needs are met and everything is kind of handed to them. So I think that in order to make a change, we have to start there. Like, we have to be willing to accept, okay, this is going to change my life. And as far as the housing situation go, like Howard said, it's structural. This is how our society was built. So in order to change our society as a whole, that's an even bigger problem than trying to accept it within ourselves. So I think we have to, in order to change how our society is set up, we have to want to make the change. We have to change the laws, the criminal justice system, the education system. But I think the education system is a good start because a lot of people don't know what racism is. So in order to know that I am racist myself, I will have to know what that implies, what kind of characteristics that will have to show. So I think that we should kind of start there in educating people about, like Rich said, the property and housing and different stuff like that, educate them on that first so they'll know what these barriers are that's stopping us.
Julia, on the subject of quote-unquote outing or how to interact with people like we saw in Honey Oil Falls, how do you feel about it?
I think that, like what Rachel said, having individual impact can be a great first step for people, and specifically in Honey Oil Falls, to feel like they can have change in their small community is good. But Mr. Eagle, as you were saying, I think that you're absolutely right that we can't allow that to completely take over instead of focusing on more institutional structural racism. I think that white people feel a little bit intimidated by the like a phrase like that because it feels like, oh, that's so big, how could I affect that? So I think that what needs to be had is some community discussions where there is a conversation about actual steps to move forward and not just a vague sort of, we need to dismantle structural racism, but literal steps, literal action that can be taken so that people have a mission, because that's a huge undertaking. And people need to know individually what to do. And I'm not saying that's black responsibility, because, you know, white people have Google and they shouldn't have to go to their one black friend for every single piece of information. But that means that research has to be done. And that means as a community, Honey Oil Falls specifically, to recover from this, doesn't need to only out Jared Kuhn and basically renounce his views. But there needs to also be a community conversation about how to affect the institution, such as a sociology class being incorporated into the curriculum so that education can come to the forefront and these kids can grow up in Honolulu Falls learning about the opportunities that they have that other people don't, and they can learn the things that they sometimes don't learn until college or ever.
Okay. And Rabbi Stein, when you have people who are fearful that someone lives in our community who shouted anti-Semitic slurs in Charlottesville marching, we have to call them out. I want to know who that is. You know, and the mayor saying, look, we can renounce those views without threatening families, you know, draw that line, but do we reach out individually? Is it worth reaching out individually? Is it worth confronting people more individually? Do you worry that that starts to get a little precarious in certain communities? I mean, how do you feel about that?
So I think that there's obviously a delicate balance between recognizing that these are structural issues. These are, whether it's law or policy or practice, we have to recognize there is that structural societal level, but we can never stop by calling things out on an individual level, because if we don't call out an individual who participates in whatever kind of hateful act or hateful speech, then we're saying it's acceptable. So I think that we have to say there's zero tolerance for this. If someone takes action in this way, if someone does something that is harmful or hurtful, then we have to call them out as an individual and create that sense of individual accountability. And that goes on both the negative side and on the positive side. We talk about someone from Hanoi Falls, but very easily we can take ownership of that in Brighton and in Pittsburgh and other communities as well. We had the episode with the hate flyers that went through both of those communities recently. We also have positive things that have happened in those communities. So following on the terrible event in Charlottesville, where the synagogue there was under assault, I had a gentleman come to me at the synagogue here in Rochester and say, I'm not Jewish. I've never been to a Jewish worship service, but I know that this anti-Semitism happened. I'm here to help if you need me. I will stand guard in your parking lot if you need me, whatever else it is. And that's the other kind of individual accountability, is that one person can truly make a difference.
Can I make one more comment on this point? Because this is a critical point. Of course, no one would say we should not call out people who are racist. I don't believe reasonable people would say that. But we need to do that and keep moving. So what this raises is, why weren't people who are racist called out before now? Why did it take a Charlottesville for us to call out racist people? I heard Julia earlier talking about all kind of racists in Honey Yard Falls, just as they are in Rochester, just as they are in Brighton and Pittsburgh, and we know it. And so that's a critical question. Why wasn't that work happening before Charlottesville, right? And what's going to happen after we forget about Charlottesville in a couple of weeks, like we forgot about Ferguson? Then we go back to the norm, which is the deep-seated denial and no discussion and so forth. This needs to be ongoing work all the time. And just this point that you raised, Julia, about white people taking responsibility, education is, you know, it's more accessible than ever. That's right. White people, all people should take responsibility to educate themselves on this, but that's not always a simple task. So I'm not against those who know most, who have the most knowledge, the clearest understanding, leading. And people who don't should be willing to follow.
All right, let me grab another phone call. Sam in Rochester. And Sam, we got to keep it tight. Go ahead, Sam.
Well, you know, I hear the young lady talking about she had to educate herself on racism and, you know, what racism is. You're talking to people who have really probably have never experienced racism, like someone from the South, like myself, who have worked in the fields and who have been misused and abused. And not just me being misused and abused, but my mother and my father being misused and abused. I know what racism looked like, and nobody had to teach me what racism looked like. And you're talking about the kids out in Henrietta. The kids didn't come by that by osmosis. Those kids was taught that by their parents. So rather than teaching the kids, you need to teach the parents what racism is and not participate in racism. But I don't want to get too tied up in the racism part. I came from Georgia, and I came from Georgia for a purpose, and that was to make a better life for myself and my family. So I had to forget those things which were behind and press towards those things which were in front of me, and that was to make a life better for myself. And the people up here didn't have anything to do with what happened to me in Georgia. There's something called forgiveness, and we have to forgive one another before we can move forward in this world.
Sam, thanks for the phone call. Howard?
Yes, let me say this, Sam. I identify, I'm the son of migrant farm workers. I'm from the peasantry class in this nation, which some historians claim don't exist, but I know it does because I'm part of it. Now, and I agree with you 100%. Many of us came north looking for a better way of life. I have some disagreement around the idea that what was happening in the North had nothing to do with what was happening to us in the South. It did. It's one nation. It was one group of laws, one group of policy practices. And even when we believe that those didn't play out the same in the North, they absolutely did in a fundamental sense. Things may have been a little easier, but again, back to structural racism, it was not fundamentally different in the North than it was in the South, including slavery, which many people don't know. But you're raising some excellent points, and we're always appreciative to Evan and others who will give us a platform to talk about these issues. But what's also clear is we need lots of time to talk about this, but not too much time, because after we get done talking, we need to act.
All right, so maybe this is a good way to close the conversation. We're down to our last minute. Howard, where would you direct people for more information, either on MAMA or other resources?
Yes, indeed. You can reach MAMA at our Facebook page, at MAMA, Movement for Anti-Racist Ministry in Action. If I can do a plug, we have a meeting tomorrow night at 4 East Henrietta Road at the Cross of the Savior Church. People are welcome to come. Tonight, we have a meeting at the Central Church of Christ, the Take It Down Planning Committee. The two organizations are working closely together around trying to impact racism in real, concrete, measurable ways. We invite everybody to come out and get involved, because this won't change unless we take intelligent, focused, direct action.
All right, so it's the Movement for Anti-Racist Ministry in Action. There is a Facebook page. You not only learn more about it, but also, again, see the events that Howard is talking about. Howard and Rachel from the Steering Committee, thank you both for being here. Really appreciate both of your time.
Thank you so much.
A lot more conversations to have. Julia, good luck to you. Thanks for taking the time to share your thoughts.
Thank you very much.
And Rabbi Stein, see you at Temple Brith Kodesh. Thank you so much for your perspective as well, Rabbi.
Thank you very much, Evan.
All right, short break. More connections coming up.